From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress Tracy Ullman. She's starring in the new Woody Allen movie, Small Time Crooks. She's won Emmys for her HBO comedy series and for her brief stint as a therapist on Ally McBeal. Also, how former Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley rebuilt the city in a way that virtually ensured it would be segregated. Daley is the subject of the new book, American Pharaoh. We'll talk to the book's authors. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews White Teeth, a debut novel which has already been a bestseller in England. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A committee of the Arkansas Supreme Court says President Clinton should be stripped of his license to practice law in the state for serious misconduct. The panel said the president should be disbarred for giving false testimony about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. The recommendation now goes to a circuit court in Little Rock. President Clinton's attorney, David Kendall, issued a statement saying the committee's recommendation is wrong and he'll vigorously dispute it in court. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is calling for thousands more troops to reinforce peacekeepers in South Lebanon, where Israel is withdrawing from its occupation zone. Israel's allied militia, the South Lebanon Army, abandoned 15 villages today, creating havoc in the region. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Dozens of pro-Israeli militiamen fled to Israel's border today and asked for asylum after they left villages in South Lebanon. At least four Lebanese civilians were reported killed in the chaos today. Witnesses said two of the civilians died when Israeli tanks and helicopter gunships opened fire on the crowd, while Israel said fire from its militia, the South Lebanon Army, was responsible. The other two apparently died when Israeli artillery hit an abandoned militia post. Thousands of Lebanese rushed into the villages after the SLA left, some reuniting with family they haven't seen in 20 years of Israeli occupation. Hezbollah guerrillas also took over these villages, taking weapons and ammunition abandoned there. Israeli officials warned Hezbollah against any attacks on northern Israel. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The tobacco industry is trying to convince a Miami jury that has changed the way it does business and does not deserve to be punished with a huge punitive damage award. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports from Miami.
Lawyers for the tobacco industry have started their opening statements in a landmark Florida class action lawsuit. The Miami jury has already found that tobacco companies make a deadly and addictive product and tried to hide it from smokers. Now they're deciding how much the company should pay in punitive damages for an estimated 500,000 Florida smokers. Philip Morris attorney Dan Webb told jurors they have the discretion to determine that no punitive damages are needed and that the industry will establish that their verdict should be zero. He said the jury's earlier verdict was for past conduct and that the tobacco companies today have changed their ways. He pointed to youth smoking prevention programs and new website admissions on the health risks of smoking. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Miami.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 84 points to close at 10,542. Declines led advances by 3-2 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 867 million shares. This is NPR News. A jury in Houston, Texas, has recommended the death penalty for Angel Maturino Resendiz, the so-called railroad killer. The jury convicted Resendiz in the murder of a Houston physician, but he's confessed to the killings of 9 people in 3 states. In a presidential election year seen as critical to the organization, the National Rifle Association has re-elected Charlton Heston as its leader. Mark Rumsey reports from member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina.
A change in the NRA's governing rules last year allowed the organization to re-elect Heston to an unprecedented third term as president. The actor-turned-activist has taken a high profile with the NRA, which says its membership has swelled to more than 3.5 million. Heston says he expects the NRA to have 4 million members by Election Day. During the group's annual meeting in Charlotte, Heston and other top NRA leaders took repeated jabs at the Clinton-Gore administration's gun control efforts. The NRA plans to spend $10 million this year getting its message out before November. For NPR News, I'm Mark Rumsey in Charlotte.
The Supreme Court has struck down a law restricting sex-oriented cable channels. In a 5-4 ruling, the justices found that Congress violated constitutional rights to free speech by requiring cable TV systems to restrict sex-oriented material to late-night hours if the networks don't fully scramble their signal for non-subscribers. The court upheld a lower court ruling finding there are less restrictive ways to address the issue. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 26 points today to close at 3,364. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the funniest actresses working today, a genius at portraying different types of characters, Tracy Ullman. After coming to the U.S. from England, she established herself through her Fox and HBO TV series. Tracy Ullman co-stars in Woody Allen's new movie, Small Time Crooks. Woody Allen plays an incompetent crook. He's a schlemiel who thinks he's smart. He served time in prison and is now stuck in a dishwashing job, while his wife, Frenchie, played by Ullman, works as a manicurist. In this scene, early in the film, he tells her he has a new scheme that will require investing their entire savings.
Frenchie, I need our 6,000 bucks.
What?
I gotta have our 6 G's.
That's our whole savings.
Yeah, I know. Don't get dramatic about it.
Come on, Ray. 6 G's. That's all we got, right?
Frenchie, I got a brilliant idea. I'm going to make us rich.
How are you going to make us rich? Rob a bank?
How'd you know that? That's fantastic. How'd you guess that?
What?
That's fantastic. First shot out of the box. You got it.
Is that why Tommy Beale's coming over and Denny?
Frenchie, what would you say if I told you that you were married to a very brilliant man?
I'd say I'd have to be a bigamist.
Although the heist Woody Allen is planning fails, it inadvertently leads the couple into a fortune, and money changes everything. Tracy Ullman, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's nice to be back.
Describe your character of Frenchie.
Working class, hardworking, and she's not stupid, you know, she's not a dumb broad. Horrible dress sense. I wear some horrific outfits in
this
film.
We'll get to that in a moment.
I think she's kind of bright. She says something in the film which is kind of sad, and you realize she says, you know, I was smart at school. I wanted to stay on at school, but there was always some emergency. And you think, oh, what does that mean? You know, she was always, like, made to look after a younger sibling at home or something and therefore didn't get the education she would have wanted. And that was a key sort of thing to say about the character for me.
No, the character in the first part of the film particularly dresses quite badly. There's some lime green stretch pants that you you have to wear early on.
Yeah, they're really bad. I mean, you know, there should be a legging law, you know. Me and my daughter Mabel always think that anyone over 6 months should be banned from wearing leggings because they're very offensive to us fashion-wise. You know, when you see those women with the VPL, the old visible panty lines.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
There's nothing worse than a woman who's had 3 kids who's like, I got my figure back, and she's wearing leggings. And so we think they're vile. And I wear a lot of leggings in the movie. I wear, like, some sort of bad fashion items from the late 90s, like the shrug. Did you get into the shrug, Terry?
Wait, what's a shrug?
It's like a mini cardigan. It's got arms, but it just like sits over your shoulders.
Oh, I didn't know there was a name for that.
Oh, it's horrible. It cuts into everyone's armpits, and I get to wear a pink, fluffy shrug. I look kind of like a Muppet. And I got to wear a Biore nose strip. Biore would be very thrilled
with
me.
Oh, I thought that's what it was. First, I thought, oh, did she get someone break her nose and she got bandaged? And I thought, no, it's one of those pimple strips for the nose.
Yeah, that girl rips it off and goes, ew, looks like a porcupine. You know that? And I thought every woman in America will know what I'm doing here, because we've all sort of experimented with those strips.
You know how actors talk about how, like, if you put on period clothes, you're taken to another era and it makes it easier to get into character.
Mm.
Well, when you put on your shrug or your lime green stretch pants to get into character, what does it do for you?
It makes my ass look enormous. My son said, "Yeah, you look fat," when he saw the film. I said, "Yeah, well, you'd look fat in lime green leggings. And Kate Moss would look fat in lime green leggings, Johnny, you know." It's just great. Yeah, I mean, I love dressing up. I've always seemed to wear the most ridiculous things. And I rarely dress in anything where I'd want to keep the wardrobe. But I love it.
Who dressed you for the movie?
Suzanne McCabe is the costume designer on this film. She'd been an assistant of Jeffrey Kurland, who'd done most of Woody's movies for years. And so I'd worked with her before. And she got promoted this year. And we spent about 4 days getting ready for this movie, just surrounding ourselves in all these shoulder pads and, you know, all these different fabrics. And what's so great in this movie is that I go from rags to riches. So there's so much fun in playing nouveau riche. You know, somebody who wore lime green leggings and pink fluffy shrugs, you know, I then get to have money. And so there's a lot of tight sort of business suits with shoulder pads and Versace type things. And my hair was great fun to do too. I wore two different wigs for the movie, the poor hair and rich hair. So that, you know, when I'm in my lime green legging phase, as we should refer to it from now on as, I had that horrid sort of badly processed, dyed, permed hair. You know, you get what you pay for with hairdressing. And then I imagine that it's when she gets in the money, you know, somebody says, you know, we really should, you know, just help your hair a little. You know, she said the buttery chunk highlights put in. She probably goes to a salon uptown. And they did that blow-dried look, you know, that blowout style that everyone seems to had the last couple of years. And then, of course, for evening, if you have hair like Frenchie, you do the Ivana Trump look. You know, up it goes and the little spiky bits with the gel. And so I had a lot of fun with my look.
So did you go shopping with the woman who was the clothes designer for the movie?
No, I can't do that all going shopping again because it drives you mad in stores. Because if you try something awful on when you're, you know, creating a character and the shop assistant goes, "Oh, you look fabulous." You're like going, "Do you think I would honestly wear this? What's the matter with you? You retarded or something?" You know, and then you tend to get offended, you know. So, and also people recognize me sometimes now. So,
right, sure.
I'd rather just do it in the privacy of my own dressing room.
So they brought you back the stuff.
Yeah.
Do you fit in off-the-rack stuff, or do you have clothes made for you?
So I like vintage stuff. I find that very interesting now. I like, because you can find something unique. There's no point in buying a designer dress, you know, you splash out for it, and the next week it's on Shania Twain in The Enquirer, Yasmin Bleeth in The Globe, you know, Carmen Electra in a Miami courtroom appearance, and you think, oh, blimey, I spent all that money, you know, so I like vintage, but vintage is a bit smelly, isn't it?
Well,
Terry, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
When you get the little arm shield, armpit shields from the 30s, and you go out in a vintage dress and you start having a dance or something, and then you release a lot of 30s BO. You go, "That's not my BO. Oh my God, it's 1937 BO within the," you know what I mean? They get a bit smelly.
Let's talk about the accent that you use in the movie. I mean, you know, the speaking style. Could you describe how the character speaks?
I talked to Woody before we did the movie, and I guess I've really established myself with that Long Island Jewish thing, you know, and I think we realized they weren't Jews. Because they get nouveau riche, you know, like Jewish people would never have people tell them what to do. Do you know what I mean? Or how to dress. Because in the movie, I want to be told how to dress, how about culture, about museums, about art. And I thought, you know, this is somebody that is maybe from Jersey, Brooklyn. And then I had a wonderful makeup artist on the movie called Rosemary Swirlow. And she says things like weren't. You know, when New Yorkers say things like weren't. And She used to be an operator for the telephone company. So I would say, "How did you used to talk when you were an operator, Rosemary?" Just hear her voice, you know. "You got to talk to my supervisor. You know, I'm putting you on hold. Hello, operator." And she has this lovely, very feminine voice. And so I would get Rosemary to read my lines for me a lot of the time. And other elements of, you know, people too. But Rosemary was a big inspiration to me.
You have a lot of really hard T's at the end of words, like got.
Got and David. You know, like if somebody says David, but they say David. And it's an affectation I notice, especially when working class women are trying to talk better. You know, because Frenchie becomes something better in this movie. So it's like she starts to, oh, I love art. I love it. Picasso, Rembrandt, you know, the boys. And it was that kind of, you know, very aware of how she's sounding. Because like my mom, when she answers the phone, you know, it's 6470468. And you go, hello, mom, it's me. Oh, hello. No, it's that telephone voice thing.
Now, tell us more about what you have to do when you're creating a character for a movie. And this is interesting because it's a character you're keeping for 90 minutes. It's not a sketch that's just going to be 3 minutes.
I was sent this script and I was told a man would come to my office. I had a strange sort of Italian name. And he was going to sit there while I read the script and then he would take it away again. It was all very secretive, you know.
You mean that he was going to, like Woody Allen was going to send a secret agent?
Yeah.
To give you the
this
script.
This guy called Martinelli arrives. He sits in reception. And I was told I had to read the script. And when I'd read it, I would just hand it straight back to him, you know, in a plain brown envelope. And I did ring Woody's office straight away and said, please, can I keep it? Because I would love to do it. And I need to read it some more to really get working on it if you're offering it to me. And then you're right, to sustain something over 90 minutes, it's a different sort of discipline. But it's such a good story, it does sustain.
So what other things did you have to do to inhabit this character? What other research, places you had to go, people you had to talk to?
I don't know why, it was kind of there for me, Terry. I spend a lot of time in New York. Woody doesn't rehearse, which I don't mind because I'm very spontaneous. The show that I write and do, I've been writing it for 9 months, so I've kind of rehearsed in my head, and I don't have time to rehearse with actors. They just show up on the day and we do it. It's in the clothes, it's in the wigs. I talked about that, really important to me. It's in my nails, particularly for this role. I grew them. I never have long nails. I have the ability to grow them.
And they were polished.
I polished them every night. They were like my pet thing, you know. Don't touch me. Don't knock me. And my nails, you know. I can't wash up. I can't do that. And my nails became a thing. And my hands moved differently with this character. And I just, when they said finally cut wrap and everything, I cut them off within 3 minutes. They were so irritating. You can't do anything with long nails.
Now, you talked about not rehearsing for Woody Allen's films.
No.
Can you say that you want another take? Can you say to him, I'm not happy with what I did in that take?
Oh, yes. He's very giving. I mean, he's very, you know, he's... it's a very calm set, actually, Woody Allen films. It's people that are there that have worked with him for a long time. You're all there because you're there to do the best possible work. You're certainly not there for the money. Nobody has big trailers and cappuccino machines and nutritionists and all that excess stuff that just slows everything down and is a nightmare to me. That's what I don't like about movies, all the fuss. You know, I work in TV and it's fast and it's spontaneous and here we go. And films, it's like, oh, 3 hours to set up a shot with two people. I think it's a waste of time. And everyone's supposed to look beautiful all the time and everyone's touching their lip lines up and they're brushing hairs out of their eyes. And it's totally unnatural to me, all that. I hate it. Because I come from wanting to be an actress, I love Ken Loach films and Mike Leigh films, and you don't even have makeup artists on that. You just make yourself up and turn up, you know, because it's real.
Because
I'm not into the glamour business of it all, you know. So, anyway, to go back to that's what I love about Woody's pictures. It's very no-nonsense. You notice he does a lot of things in one shot. There's not coverage, and which drives you crazy and totally ruins the rhythm of a scene, especially with comedy. He can get away with that on a big screen, though. I think it's difficult to do on television. And he's very generous and very... He has a lot of confidence in me now, which I'm really proud that he does. And he will say, would you like another take? And you want to say this, that's okay. But if you'd like to say that, that's okay. And make it your own type of thing. And so there's a lot of freedom.
My guest is Tracy Ullman. She stars in Woody Allen's new movie, Small Time Crooks. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tracy Ullman, and she stars with Woody Allen in the new movie Small Time Crooks. You first saw Woody Allen's movies when you were living in England.
Yes,
before you moved to the States.
Saw a few, yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, how did his very New York, Jewish neurotic personality translate to you when you were living in England and like far away from the culture that he's so representative of, you know?
I didn't get it. I really didn't get it. It was like I was 10 years old when Monty Python came out in England. I didn't get that because I wasn't a male middle to upper class university student. I sort of get it now. You need like a lifetime to figure it out. I didn't get Woody. I think I watched Annie Hall when I still lived in England. I was like, these people are so neurotic. They need a good slap. because English people don't really analyze themselves so much, just kind of get on with things. I didn't really get it. I do now. I've lived in America a long time. The first film of his that I really got and just really touched me was Broadway Danny Rose. And I think I watched that when I was pregnant with my first child and I was sort of hanging around at home a lot. And I'd sort of been watching a lot of TV to try and catch up on American humor. Like, I was watching things like The Facts of Life. I think this is American comedy. And then my husband showed me Broadway Danny Rose, and it broke my heart. I loved it so much. It's in my top three films.
This is a movie about a small-time agent.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's about a loser. It celebrates the loser. And it's so endearing and funny. And Mia Farrow was amazing, because I didn't recognize her till halfway through the movie.
Uh-huh.
And I thought America was all about, we're winners, we're special, and they never sort of like were self-depreciating. Yeah. And that I just thought, wow, that someone could make fun of themselves like that. Then I was totally hooked on Woody Allen.
What surprised you about how the real Woody Allen compared to his movie persona?
He's very quiet. I mean, it takes a while to get to know him at all. I feel I can talk to him and, you know, make jokes. And I mean, he's so much fun. If he cracks a joke, it's always just great. You know, he was sitting on the set one day looking through the Village Voice, and usually the guys can talk to him about the Knicks. And he was looking through the personal ads of the Village Voice, and he said to his assistant, Lauren, he said, oh, they're still looking for 212 lesbians. And she said, oh, Woody, that means like the area code, like 212 Manhattan lesbians. And I thought, he knows. I love that. He doesn't want to socialise. I'm like that too. I might just want to get on with the work, you know. But I do. I just admire him enormously. And as I say, because he's so good to his crew and he's great on the set, and because I've worked with so many directors, it's all about ego and screaming at people at a certain time during the day. And I never saw him do that.
Do the controversies in his personal life complicate things working with him? Because...
Yeah, I don't get involved in that. You know, I remember when I did Bullets Over Broadway, I think he was going through a very stressful personal time then. And I remember him having to race off at certain times, I think, you know, for court appearances and things. I mean, things seem to be sort of levelling out. I mean, he seems a lot calmer. The baby is a darling and comes to the set and he loves the little Bichet. And, you know, Suni was around a lot with the baby. And I think their lives are sort of calming down somewhat. But it's really... none of my business. I'd never pass judgment on it or mention it. You know, it's not for me to say.
You're going to be doing another HBO series. Tell us something about it.
I've really enjoyed working for HBO the past 4 years. I did four seasons of Tracy Takes On. I mean, it's talking about how liberating and, you know, spontaneous Woody Allen films are. I mean, that's what I'm doing on HBO. It's like the BBC with money. I love it. For 4 years, I've been doing Tracy Takes On, where I play all these extraordinary characters and I sort of smother myself in rubber and yak hair and fat suits. And it's been enormous fun, but it's like I've proved I can do that. And I want to try and write a show this year that I play one, maybe two, or maybe three characters. My husband says, that's enough, that's enough. but, you know, to prove that I can look sort of like me and do a funny, interesting show. I mean, I do so much admire Lily Tomlin when she did Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, and she just used light and body posture to change characters. I'd like, you know, it's my time to do something like that. I got a little tired of working in all the makeup. So I'll start to write that in August. I'm gathering a team now, and it's a good idea. I'm really excited about it.
Now, is it going to be a sketch comedy or
no,
same characters every week?
Yeah, same characters every week. But so it's going to be a challenge. But I'm looking forward to it, and I'll be able to direct them all myself now because I won't be wearing so much makeup, so I won't spend all my time in makeup. I mean, I've had a couple of very good directors on Tracy Takes On, but some of the others, I don't know. I'm getting to that stage now, Terry, where I just want to... I want to do everything. I want total control. And I can't be doing with someone who doesn't do it right. You know, I know too much. Listen, longevity in this business. I'm a veteran of this business. I can't be doing with stupid directors. I want to do it myself.
Was makeup really what was holding you back from directing? Because you had to spend so much time getting the costumes?
Yes, there's a big reason. A big reason. And also, you know, really feeling now that I know... I first started to go in the editing room, and from editing I really learnt about shots and lenses and all that stuff, and I really feel confident to go and tell people how to do it now and to do that. I mean, you have to learn, it's a process, but I feel ready to do it now and act in it.
Well, I wish you good luck with the series.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you again for talking with us.
Oh, it's always lovely to talk to you. You're such a good interviewer. You're a doll.
Tracy Ullman stars in the new Woody Allen movie, Small Time Crooks. I'm Cherie Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Random House's The Dial Press Division, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler, a collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens chronicling our country's history. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, how Richard J. Daley transformed Chicago during his two decades as mayor. We'll talk to the authors of a new biography. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the British bestseller White Teeth.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. Bet your bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago. Chicago, the town that Marty Faye could not shut down. On State Street, that great street, I just want to say, they do things that they don't do on Broadway. Say, they have
have the time of their life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago hometown.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new biography of Chicago's former mayor, Richard J. Daley, is a study of a brilliant machine politician who amassed incredible power and rebuilt his city for better and for worse. The book American Pharaoh credits Daley with ensuring Chicago's place as the most segregated large city in the U.S. and turning the city into a civil rights battleground. The authors described Daley in the late 60s as an icon of working-class resentment toward the anti-war movement and the youth-oriented counterculture. Richard J. Daley was Chicago's mayor from 1955 to his death in 1976. His son, Richard M. Daley, is the city's current mayor. My guests are the authors of American Pharaoh. Adam Cohen covers politics for Time magazine. Elizabeth Taylor is literary editor and Sunday magazine editor of the Chicago Tribune. Before we get to the negative ways in which Richard J. Daley rebuilt Chicago, let's look at some of the projects during his years as mayor that changed the city for the better.
Almost every major project you can think of in Chicago started under Daley, from O'Hare Airport, the world's busiest, to Sears Tower, the tallest building in the world at the time, major highway construction, the Gold Coast emerged under him, major parts of the city were redeveloped. But probably his biggest achievement was taking the Loop, the downtown area, which was really in decline. Nelson Algren had said it was like a jukebox winding down in an old bar, and making it incredibly vibrant.
How did he do that?
He formed a very close alliance with the business community, and he neglected the neighborhoods, but he worked very closely with downtown businessmen and essentially let them come up with the plan for Chicago. They wrote the 1958 development plan, and Daley just put all of his political power behind it and did everything they wanted.
Now, you point out in your book how Mayor Daley rebuilt the city into a very segregated one. You say he used public housing as a place to house blacks and keep them away from white neighborhoods. How did his choice of locations for public housing help enforce segregation in Chicago?
Well, Chicago has been called by social scientists the most hyper-segregated city in America. And when you look at the layout, it really is an amazing example of planned segregation. There's what's called the State Street Corridor, which is a long four-mile strip of public housing on the south side, which has 40,000 people living in public housing in a very densely concentrated area. Daley built much of that State Street Corridor, including the Robert Taylor Homes, the largest public housing project in the world. And he then separated it from the white parts of the south side by building the Dan Ryan Expressway, the widest highway in the world at the time it was built. And it exactly follows the racial barrier, the racial line on the south side. It was all done very intentionally. And a federal agency later referred to the State Street Corridor and the Robert Taylor Homes as filing cabinets for the poor.
Yeah, those are high rises, and Daley had a lot of high rises built as public housing projects. Did he have ulterior motives for favoring high rises?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he wasn't the only one who favored high rises. The black machine also favored them for the same reason Daley did. It was a lot easier to control votes in high rises than it would be in apartments spread out.
Why is it easier to control votes in a high-rise?
Because a precinct worker can just go up and down the steps and knock and get promises. They can also, because the residents are sort of dependent, they can use threats that perhaps they would be evicted so that they would vote the way the machine wanted them to vote.
Now, in terms of getting the residents of the housing projects to get out and vote, it would be quite a paradox if, Mayor Daley, who put African Americans in these, filing drawers, and who intentionally segregated blacks from whites, it would be very ironic if African Americans actually voted for him.
But in fact, it was quite true that they voted for him. In fact, an example of that is the 1963 election, when he lost the white vote, but won because so many blacks supported him.
One of the most interesting things we came across in researching the book was the pre-civil rights black community in Chicago. And this was all the pre-civil rights era, before Martin Luther King and so forth. And it was amazing the extent to which blacks did just follow the orders of the black submachine. There was a man named William Dawson, who was the head of the black submachine. He was at one time the only black congressman in the United States. And Dawson just had these votes under his control, and he didn't want integration, and somehow he kept everyone in line. And one of the really interesting stories in the book is the evolution from pre-civil rights black awareness to post-civil rights black awareness. And one transitional figure is a congressman named Ralph Metcalf, who at a certain point left the old ways behind, became pro-civil rights, and actually said at one point, it's never too late to become black. So what we have is early on blacks who in some ways were kind of bamboozled into voting against their own self-interest.
Why did Mayor Daley want to keep the city segregated?
A lot of it is sort of his roots, where he came from. This is a guy who grew up in Bridgeport, which was an all-white working-class neighborhood on the South Side. He was very much in tune with the people of Bridgeport. He started out his life as a member of a youth gang called the Hamburg Athletic Club, which was very much involved in the 1919 race riots, beating up black people. And, you know, we don't know for sure that Daley beat up black people, but he was elected president of the club just a few years after that. He was a guy who believed in races living in their own neighborhoods, not having much contact. And he sort of took that world of Bridgeport and expanded it to, you know, become the whole city of Chicago.
Chicago is known as the city of neighborhoods. And Daley really believed in that. He believed in small, exclusive neighborhoods throughout the city that would be divided by ethnicity and race.
And you don't like to lightly use the word racist, but Daley, just by contemporary standards, wasn't someone who really ever felt comfortable with black people. He had almost none of them around him ever. He didn't have them in his cabinet. He didn't like to, you know, treat them as equals. He was not interested in whites and blacks really, you know, getting to know each other very much. And he built a city that reflected those values.
What's the legacy of these housing projects in Chicago?
You know, Daley's legacy is still very strong here in Chicago, and the State Street corridor is still very much intact, and many people, you know, still live there. And one of the things we were fascinated to find is that something like 7 out of the top 10 poorest census tracts in the United States are in Chicago public housing, which is striking when you realize what a rich city this is. You know, that these census tracts are not in Mississippi, they're not in Alabama, they're very close to the Gold Coast of Chicago. And it's a testament to how what Daley built into concrete in the 1950s continues to dominate, you know, one of the biggest cities in the country.
My guests are Adam Cohn and Elizabeth Taylor, authors of a new biography of Richard M. Daley called American Pharaoh. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Adam Cohn and Elizabeth Taylor, authors of the new book American Pharaoh, Mayor Richard Daley and the Battle for Chicago and the Nation. You describe Daley as perhaps the shrewdest retail politician in U.S. history. What do you mean by retail politician?
Well, one of the things about this story that we loved is that the way politics is done now is so different. It's all about media buys and raising large amounts of money. And, you know, George Bush and Al Gore rarely meet an actual voter anymore. Daley was a guy who there was very little TV involved in campaigns back then, very little fundraising. It was really Daley went to every ward organization, all 50 of them, regularly, met with voters, told them jokes, encouraged the precinct captains to get out a big vote. It's a kind of politics that you know, it was really interesting. And one of the fun things about working on this book was sort of harking back to that, you know, more retail, more personal form of politics, which largely doesn't exist anymore.
You say he controlled about 40,000 patronage jobs. What kind of jobs, and how did he use the patronage workers?
the jobs range from high to low. If you wanted to be a judge in Chicago, it was done through the patronage system. But also the guy who operated the elevator at City Hall, who actually wasn't needed because there were buttons there, he was also a patronage worker. And these were all jobs that were very carefully allotted through ward committeemen, through precinct captains. There was a very rigid hierarchy as to how they were done. And it was an incredibly powerful political tool. Political scientists estimate that each patronage worker was good for about 10 votes when you count his family and the votes that he was able to pull out on election day. So that meant that those 40,000 workers translated into 400,000 votes on election day that the machine started with. So it's no wonder it was very hard for insurgents to ever defeat the machine.
Now, because he controlled the Illinois delegation, you say he became a kingmaker in selecting Democratic candidates for president. Who was Daley most significant in selecting?
The 1960 election was crucial. I mean, that's how when Bobby Kennedy said about Richard J. Daley, he is the ball game, reflecting on how Daley had helped elect his brother, John F. Kennedy, president.
Daley created Adlai Stevenson, who was the Democratic Party nominee, twice in the 1950s. Adlai Stevenson was basically selected by the Chicago machine. He was very influential with the Kennedys and really all the way through. He actually played a role in selecting Jimmy Carter in the last year of his life.
What did Daley do to help get Kennedy elected?
Well, he stole Illinois for him, for one thing. The margin in Illinois was under 9,000 votes, and there's just no question that the machine stole more than 9,000 votes in that race. What was interesting is that his motivation may not have been to help Kennedy. There was actually a very hard-fought local race for an office called State's Attorney, which was a prosecuting office that had the potential to put the entire machine in jail and eventually did put a lot of them in jail. And that was the race they were really stealing votes for. But they ended up stealing enough to get Kennedy the state of Illinois also.
When you say stealing votes, what exactly do you mean?
Well, it was pretty blatant. In Chicago, there was what was known as four-legged voting, where the precinct captain actually walked into the machine with voters and helped them to pull the machine lever. Captains also often just walked into the machines themselves and just started voting as many times as they wanted to. We talked to one reporter who was examining all this in the 70s, and he saw a precinct captain vote 70 times. There also was a guy named Short Pencil Louie who was photographed during Daley's first election just erasing votes for Daley's opponent on paper ballots and writing them in for Daley. So vote theft was incredibly blatant.
One of the things Mayor Daley was most famous for nationally was the way he handled the Chicago Convention protesters in 1968. What did he think the impact would be on his legacy to have the police attack the protesters?
And Daley was about control. He was a man who believed strongly in order and ruliness. He believed in the Catholic Church hierarchy. He believed in the machine hierarchy. And he believed that this was his city and no one else was going to take control of it. So he had no problem really coming down hard on the protesters. And, you know, the historical context is also that Martin Luther King had been assassinated a few months before the convention, and there had been, you know, terrible riots in Chicago, which very much upset Daley watching parts of the city burn. And he was just committed that no one was going to do anything that he didn't want done. And he didn't mind busting heads and throwing tear gas and shoving innocent people through, you know, store windows downtown, which his police did all of. That was fine with him because it was about keeping order.
Martin Luther King, after winning the Nobel Peace Prize, decided to take the movement, the civil rights movement, north to Chicago. And he lived there for, I think, about 8 months. You say that Mayor Daley had a strategy that was a brilliant campaign of his own. He refused to let the movement cast him as a villain. What was Daley's strategy?
Strategy was to kill Martin Luther King with kindness. And then, when Martin Luther King got on the plane to return, he reneged on all the promises he'd made.
Because Daley had seen what had gone on in the South, and he realized that, you know, Sheriff Clark in Alabama and George Wallace and all of these people, you know, getting tough with the civil rights movement made for terrible television and ultimately was the reason King was able to succeed. So Daley just vowed that there were going to be no television images like that out of Chicago. And in fact, when King showed up in Chicago, Daley sent Marciniak, who is the head of his Human Rights Commission, to the airport to meet him. They brought him down to City Hall. King met with the police chief. It was really, the red carpet was rolled out so that there'd be none of this sense that Daley was the villain. And then the other thing that Daley did just so shrewdly was he co-opted all of King's issues. When King started talking about slums, Daley talked about slums even more. And in that period in 1966, when King was here, Daley was Mr. Slum Removal. He was closing down housing that was inadequate. He was giving speeches every day. And, you know, sure enough, as soon as King left town, Daley stopped caring about slums.
Was Mayor Daley connected to organized crime?
Very much so. In fact, there were 11 wards in Chicago that they called the Automatic 11 that were the wards that really kept the machine in power. And two of those were very much controlled by the mob, particularly one. The first ward was totally bought and sold by the syndicate, as it's called in Chicago. And as a member of the machine, Daley believed the syndicate was entitled to its share of the goods, just as every other constituency was. And what Daley did when he came into office in 1955 was he shut down a unit of the Chicago Police Department called Scotland Yard, which was in the middle of a huge investigation of the syndicate. And there were celebrations in mob circles. In fact, even Time magazine did a story about one mafia don in Chicago having a really big party after Daley was elected because the heat was off.
Was Richard Daley ever more ambitious than being mayor? Did he have higher aspirations than that, or was he content to remain mayor of Chicago?
Daley didn't mind if occasionally his name was bandied about as a potential candidate for governor, but he really looked as far as the 50 wards in Chicago. He loved the city, and he understood that the greatest power he would have was as mayor of the city.
And also, we live in a very national culture now, so it's hard to kind of, you know, wrap your mind around this. But back then, you know, for people like Daley, Chicago was more important than the nation and the world. And it was actually true that back then they would bring back U.S. congressmen and tell them, okay, you know, a ward has opened up. You can run for alderman. And that would be considered good news. I mean, this was where the action was for them. And once you've controlled Chicago, you know, for people like Daley, you know, going off and being a U.S. senator or moving to Springfield as governor or joining a cabinet, you know, that's a step down.
Was there a point when Mayor Daley started to look like a political dinosaur?
Daley had a big setback in 72 at the convention when actually an insurgent group of delegates led by Jesse Jackson and William Singer were seated instead of the machine slate because of the McGovern rules, as they called them. There was a ruling that Daley's slate was not democratically elected. And that really was a major turning point for Daley at the national scene. He had been sort of thrown out of the party that he had devoted his life to, and was sort of downhill from there afterwards. He also, under the Nixon administration, was being, you know, prosecuted right and left, and a lot of his friends were being sent to jail. So yeah, his final convention in New York in 1976, when Jimmy Carter had sort of wrapped it all up, Daley was just sort of sitting there, and, you know, people walked by him and thought, you know, this is really a guy from another era.
Richard J. Daley's son, Richard M. Daley, is currently the mayor of Chicago. What is he doing to carry on his father's legacy or to change things from his father's day?
Well, he's really presiding over the city that his father created. The heavy lifting of building Chicago as a segregated city was done by his father in the 50s and 60s. And he doesn't need to do much as long as he doesn't do anything to change it. And not very much has changed or is changing. When Liz moved to Chicago years ago, I asked her, you know, what it was like compared to New York. And she said that when she took her commute in the morning from the Gold Coast to downtown Chicago, she didn't see a single black person, which is just not the experience you have in New York. And that's something that the father did, but, you know, the son now presides over.
It's kind of like Chicago's a family business. And Richard J. Daley built the factory, and Richard M. Daley presides over the making of the widgets.
Well, Richard J. Daley was able to do everything he did in Chicago with the help of this incredible machine that he headed up. what's left of that machine and how much machine power does his son have now?
Today's machine is very much watered down, and the reason for that is at the core of the machine always was the patronage system. Machine politicians like Patty Bowler, who we talk about in the book, always boasted that their workers would deliver on election day because their jobs depended on it, whereas the reformers were just sort of doing it out of some abstract notion of what was right. Those jobs, by and large, don't exist anymore. In the 1970s, there were a series of rulings called the Shachtman Decrees, which ruled that the patronage system in Chicago was illegal, and it really dismantled the patronage machine. So that was the driving force behind Chicago's machine politics, and without it, you still have precinct captains who go door-to-door on election day. There still are ward organizations, but they don't have anywhere near the power that they once had. And then also television has been a major, major factor. People now can make their own decisions about candidates by what they see in their living room every night. They don't need the guy who stops by and has a cup of coffee and hands them a palm card.
Do you think that there were a lot of cities that had people like Richard J. Daley heading them? Do you see him as unique or as just being the kind of most powerful version of his kind?
The latter. The quote that we use as the frontispiece of the book is Daley saying in 1968, this is Chicago, this is America. And that really is our view about Daley and Chicago, that it does embody larger themes that were happening everywhere. And one reason, you know, Chicago resonates so strongly is we do think of it as the most American of cities, the capital of the heartland. It was the confluence of the three great migrations that occurred in America, the immigrants who came to Chicago from overseas, the farm laborers who moved to the big city, and then the blacks who moved up from the South. It sort of captures all of that about America. And Daley sort of worked his magic to make the city that he wanted. But this was going on elsewhere. It was going on in Detroit. It was going on in New York. It was going on everywhere. But Daley's sort of the most resonant example. He's really the American icon.
I want to thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Adam Cohn and Elizabeth Taylor are the authors of American Pharaoh, a study of Chicago's former mayor, Richard J. Daley. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a British bestseller that's been published in the States. This is Fresh Air. Zadie Smith's debut novel, White Teeth, is a bestseller in Britain. It's just been published in this country and has received enthusiastic reviews. But critic Maureen Corrigan decided to see what all the fuss is about.
The question is this. Would White Teeth, a debut novel by an unknown writer named Zadie Smith, be getting all the attention it's already gotten if its author weren't a gorgeous 24-year-old black British woman who began writing the novel in her senior year at Cambridge? The answer is, are you kidding? Debut novels are born and die, quiet and unseen, every day. Then again, it was only fairly recently that gorgeous young black women could be writing novels at Cambridge at all, let alone novels as good as this one. White Teeth is ambitious, historically, geographically, and racially sprawling, and brimming with humor and tart social observations. It's just that White Teeth's smashing success makes me feel guilty about all those debut novels I haven't been tempted to sample, because their authors look more like George Eliot than George Clooney. White Teeth is set primarily in North London and tells the story of two World War II veterans and their families. It opens on a London street on New Year's Day, 1975, where one of the vets, a white working-class guy named Archie Jones, is attempting suicide in his exhaust fume-filled car. Archie's marriage has fallen apart, and his job as a printing shop paper perforator isn't meaningful enough to keep him going. But Archie's suicide is foiled when a Hindu butcher shop owner, who's busy trying to kill pigeons defecating on the sidewalk, spots Archie and rescues him. "We're not licensed for suicides around here," the shop owner tells Archie. "This place halal, kosher, understand? If you're going to die around here, my friend, I'm afraid you've got to be thoroughly bled first." That very same day, the 47-year-old Archie, who's energized by his redemption, meets Clara, a 19-year-old Jamaican woman who quickly becomes his second wife. Present at the wedding are Archie's best and only friend, Samad Iqbal, who's a Muslim Bengali waiter, and his wife. Archie and Samad became unlikely friends during World War II when they served together in a tank battalion. The novel flashes back to those terror-filled days and speeds forward into the lives of Archie's disgruntled daughter, Irie, and Samad's twin sons, who respectively become a fundamentalist terrorist and a posh lawyer. What holds the scrambled storylines of White Teeth together is Smith's unflagging inventiveness. Minor characters who appear early on in the novel pop up to play crucial roles some 300 pages later. The penetrating commentary of her heroes, as well as of her old-fashioned, all-seeing narrator, also give the novel weight. Late in the story, reflecting on the multi-culti population of modern-day England, that narrator remarks, "This has been the century of the great immigrant experiment. It is only this late in the day that you can walk into a playground and find Isaac Le Jung by the fish pond, Quang O'Rourke bouncing a basketball, children with first and last names on a direct collision course." Yet despite all the mixing up, despite the fact that we have finally slipped into each other's lives with reasonable comfort, like a man returning to his lover's bed after a midnight walk, it is still hard to admit that there is no one more English than the Indian. There are still young white men who are angry about that, who will roll out at closing time into the poorly lit streets with a kitchen knife wrapped in a tight fist. Because of social observations like that one, and because of her novel's sweep, Smith has been compared to Dickens. I think the more apt comparison would be to equally ambitious but more aloof writers like William Thackeray or Tom Wolfe. Contemporary readers sobbed over the deaths of Dickens' characters. Some of us still tear up. I didn't feel emotionally engaged that way with Smith's characters. Instead, it's the grand design of her fiction that I admired, the way she encompasses a whole teeming society within the pages of her outsized novel. White Teeth glistens with wit and energy, proof that imagination and talent can coexist with beauty. Mr. Clooney, what about it? I'm looking for another good book to curl up with.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed White Teeth by Zadie Smith. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Guru.com, staffing short-term projects in a variety of fields, including creative, technology, marketing, and strategy. Guru.com. And from Random House's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Everyday Genius by Michael J. Gelb, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the chaos in Sierra Leone. We call Sierra Leone and speak with a leader of the pro-democracy movement, and we'll talk with an American anthropologist who lived there for over 20 years. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.